You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 25th to the 31st of August 2016. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by writers Matthew Rice and Jack Grove and Deputy News Editor John Morgan. Our cover feature this week concerns the campus sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s. Were universities dens of iniquity? Or is talk of what some would call a golden age where sex was freely available whenever and wherever simply an inaccurate exaggeration? More on that from Matthew in a second. Brexit remains front and centre of many people in academia's minds, particularly the UK's position in European research programmes. John Morgan has the latest on that. And finally, how have university libraries squared up to the digital revolution? Jack Grove has been investigating. But first, our cover feature, Matthew, and it's all about sex.
It is, yes. It's a piece, it's a two-part feature, and the first part is by Lincoln Allison, and he's remembering his time. I think it's basically talking about the early 70s. And how sort of sex was suddenly, as it were, freely available. And he's you know, basically taking a very positive, nostalgic view of this time. He says at the end that he spent a decade as a libertine and four subsequent decades as a family man, and that seems like a good kind of way to have lived one's life. He notes the sort of combinations of couples which were, you know, more and more different combinations were sort of available and observed, and some didn't raise an eyebrow. So staff student was people noted, didn't notice. However, staff catering manager, people did notice that, or retired soldier and sporty student, when they were clearly getting it on together, you know, people were noticed it and commented. So he's, you know, he admits it's a very personal view and a very male view, but he's certainly taking a very positive view of something that he does see as a real change. I mean, he says there's this theory that there's just as much sex at every time in history, and that sometimes people boast about it and some people keep quiet about it. But he reckons that there was a genuine revolution in behaviour at this time.
Mm. Although he did say that Oxford, when he was a student, wasn't quite the...
Well, that was prior to the revolution he's talking about, yeah. But we thought it would be good to have a riposte to this view, and this comes from Susan Basnett, and she presents a view of basically saying it wasn't nearly as much fun for women, and she thinks there's a lot of nostalgia about it and people exaggerating what they got up to. But she also says it wasn't much fun for women, and she tells stories about, you know, what would now be considered... sexual harassment and perhaps even date rape, and she says, you know, at the time all she did was think, well, how she'd be, you know, why had she been so stupid, and how long would it take her to get home and walk home in the next morning. But she takes a decidedly less rose-tinted view of what was going on. So it's both very well written, both very articulate, taking very opposed views, but an interesting issue, and they certainly are. Certainly lots to debate and agree or disagree with.
Yeah, you can read that feature, both parts of it, from page 30 in this week's magazine. It's also on timeshighereducation.com. You'll see it on the homepage this week and thereafter by following the features link. Back to the news section. John Morgan, this week you've been looking at the after effects of the Brexit vote. What's the latest on that front?
So this is looking at what the long-term future for British universities will be once the UK is outside the European Union, assuming that that is the scenario for the future. So one assumption might be that the UK might seek to have associated country status in the EU's research programmes, which gives non-member states a similar kind of right to participate in, you know, really important EU research programmes on the same terms that member states do. But seems like that's not the automatic assumption and not necessarily going to be the default scenario. Spoke to Alistair Jarvis, who is Universities UK's Deputy Chief Executive, and he's coordinating its work on the implications of Brexit. And he said that, you know, actually... UK will be looking at all the options, and you know, we shouldn't put all our eggs in one basket until we're absolutely clear what the pros and cons of different models are, in terms of whether associated status is the right way forward. And that would be quite disturbing for some people in universities. It would mean the UK wouldn't be part of the European Research Council, which is, you know, particularly highly prestigious system of international grants. It would mean, well, I spoke to Kurt De Catalara, who's Secretary General of the League of European Research Universities. He pointed out it would mean that people with ERC grants wouldn't be able to work full-time at British universities anymore. And he said, you know, nobody's going to go to the UK anymore if the UK doesn't become an associated country. You'd be crazy to do that. But Alistair Jarvis's point was, you know, he's saying that some kind of associated country says might be the answer. But the key thing to bear in mind is that the British government looks, well, he says it's likely that they're not going to want to keep the current free movement arrangements. And with Switzerland, which is a non-member state that was, so has been associated to the EU's research programme, the EU has sort of made a demand of Switzerland after the Swiss held an immigration referendum in 2014 where they backed limits on immigration and on free movement. The EU's made a real sort of case in point to Switzerland that they will have to accept free movement if they want to carry on as an associated country. So Alistair Jarvis said, you know, it's a distinct possibility the EU might do the same as it did with Switzerland to the UK and demand continued subscription to free movement. So that's the political realities that have got to be borne in mind. Is it going to be politically achievable for the UK to carry on in the EU's research programmes?
So it's not up to the universities, basically, at the end of the day.
No, this is going to be part of much bigger political negotiations about the UK's future relationships with the EU. So it's not, I don't think it's going to be some separate tailored deal that gets done around the EU's research programmes. What the EU did with Switzerland is it's kind of used the research programmes as a bit of a stick to beat Switzerland with. So you can see how it becomes part of a much bigger bigger and more complicated political situation. But so Alistair Jarvis seemed to be saying that possibly, well, reading between the lines of what he was saying, is that UK might be sort of trying to win more concessions on the non-EU students and staff issue, whereby visa requirements have been getting tougher and tougher. Might be trying to say to the government, give us some leeway on this, and, you know, recognise that we really do need to be even more international than ever post-Brexit.
Well, it's not the last we've heard of that story, I'm sure. Page 6 and 7, though, for the latest from John, and, of course, on the website too. Finally, the second feature this week is written by Jack Grove, at least in part, and it's all about libraries and how they're changing.
Yes, so I've had the pleasure to visit quite a few libraries across the country recently, up in Liverpool and Surrey and London, and I've just sort of reflected on some of the changes we've seen over the past 10 years. I mean, when I was a student, it was pretty unusual if students were in the library at 7 or 8 o'clock. Most of them had headed home long by then, but now it seems students are in the library 24 hours a day. Librarians are, I mean, that story is quite well known, but my feature really looks at some of the other changes and how libraries have started to look quite different, feel quite different, and librarians have begun to operate in quite a different way to they used to. And just basically how libraries have really become the sort of the central part of campuses, and maybe they weren't always like that. I remember some people really kept their library use to a minimum when I was at university, but now it seems like students are, you know, having lunch there, dinner there, they're, you know, meeting their friends there, and doing a bit of studying as well. So, you know, things have really changed, and I've spoken to quite a few librarians about how they've helped to accommodate these changes. And I mean, what's interesting, I think, is that 10 years ago when the internet came and everyone said, well, we won't need to go to the library anymore because all the resources will be online, you'd imagine that the library use would go down, but actually it's rocketed in a way that no one really expected. So there's, much busier than ever.
Mm. When I was a student, it was the computer centres that were the middle of the night haunts, because the internet wasn't so easy to get hold of. I remember when an essay was due, it would be the midnight jaunt down to the university computer centre to get everything done. Frequently surrounded, I remember, by lots of international students who were emailing home and chatting with people back in the time zones where they were from originally. Well, maybe the library is now the place they go.
Well, libraries have sort of become computer centres in a way. I mean, Liverpool John Moores University has over 1,000 computer terminals across its library, which is quite amazing, and they've got another 140 or so laptops that they give out. So that's really been encouraged too. But also people just want to be in the library. It's sort of part of their of what being a student is all about nowadays. Whereas I can remember quite often I'd be the only person in the library.
Well, that's because you were so stupid. Well, there we have it. From Sex in the 60s via Brexit to libraries, don't say we don't bring you an eclectic podcast. That's all for this week's THE issue review, though. If there's anything you'd like to comment on, you can do so at timeshighereducation.com. You also find us on Twitter, Facebook and LinkedIn too, so do get in touch. But that's all for this week's THE issue review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.